morning is Grievason against Cotty.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the...
Counsel, wait, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. Your Honors, as a federal detainee at Marion County Jail, Mr. Grievason had not been convicted of any crime, yet he was subjected to something that this court has said over and over again that no prisoner must endure, a violent state of nature where jail officials are deliberately indifferent to risks of brutal assaults and overlooking of serious medical needs. Mr. Grievason has compelling claims under the Eighth Amendment standards that apply in this case, and the evidence he offered in the district court as a pro se litigant, especially contrasted to what defendants have offered, was more than sufficient to demonstrate serious fact questions and to survive summary judgment.
Mr. Sanders, let me tell you what my problem with your case is and hope you will address it as you go along. The problem, at least for me, is connecting what happened to Grievason to these defendants.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everything, please do not touch the microphone. If you would like the podium to be higher, there's a switch on your right-hand side. Almost everything that I've been able to find in the record, the plaintiff is asserting the defendants this, the defendants that, without any effort to say what particular defendants did, what they knew, when they knew it. It's a kind of guilt by association approach. Bad things happen to me, therefore, whoever I sue must be liable.
Mm-hmm.
But one must connect the defendants to the bad things. And that, it seems to me, is your client's biggest problem in this case.
Judge Easterbrook, here I assume we're talking about the claims against the individual defendants, not the official capacity claims.
The official capacity claim is subject to Monell, and you've got serious independent problems establishing the policy of the jurisdiction is to cause prisoners to be beaten and robbed and so on.
Sure.
But I'm interested at the moment, independent of Monell, in showing how each or any of the defendants is personally responsible for a particular wrong.
Of course. In describing the first attack that he suffered, Mr. Grievason specifically names the individually named defendants, the guards, Hybaugh, Cornell, Duncan, and describes the role that Mr. Boomershine had previously played in placing him in that situation. You're certainly correct that on subsequent incidents, in the record, Mr. Grievason refers to the defendants. Mr. Grievason litigated this case pro se. He wrote the affidavits pro se. Had I been his attorney at the time, would I have assisted him in writing his affidavits in a different way? Of course. I think it's important to keep in mind, though, Your Honor, Mr. Grievason asked on at least three separate occasions for assistance of counsel. Mm-hmm. The district judge denied him that. There is, of course, no right to assistance of counsel. However, this court's jurisprudence on when it's appropriate to appoint or request counsel for an indigent plaintiff is premised on the assumption that it is almost never, litigation is almost never complicated enough, almost never requires the specialized skill that's required at trial. And so I would suggest that it would be perhaps ironic and unfair to say because Mr. Grievason did not write his brief, did not write his affidavits the way an attorney would have.
I'm lost now. He has counsel, as you, on appeal. I didn't understand your brief to be saying that the district court abused his discretion in rejecting his request to recruit counsel. Have I misunderstood your brief?
No, that's correct. We have not made an abuse of discretion claim.
Since you're not making that argument, one can hardly say, well, the reason why we excuse the failings is that he didn't have counsel.
Your Honor, we work with the record.
Unless you're about to accuse yourself of ineffective assistance.
No, Your Honor.
Which is not a doctrine in civil cases anyway.
No, Your Honor. We have done the best to work with the record that Mr. Grievason created as a pro se litigant in the district court. As described in our brief, when we address the individual liability of the guards, we believe that there would be enough information for a jury based on the facts presented, the named guards, their role, their knowledge of the first attack, the fact that they were stationed in that area, the fact Mr. Grievason doesn't say guards or jail officials, he says the defendants, that this would be enough information for a jury.
You see the problem. The first attack is the one that is hardest to anticipate.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The whole story here rests on the proposition that he was attacked repeatedly, and eventually, even though he denied that he was being attacked and claimed he was stumbling and falling and so on, the guard should have seen through his falsehoods.
Mm-hmm.
So the first attack is the one that almost certainly is going to go nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, I...
Could I just interrupt? Because I understand that some of the inmates attacking him called him, you know, a snitch. But did any of the jail officials know that the attackers had labeled him as a snitch? And if so, which officials? Now, I cannot, as I sit here, recall the name of the guard during that one attack who told him to learn to fight harder. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine that there's a pretty good case right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, learn to fight harder.
Or don't come to jail.
Or don't come to jail mm-hmm. while you're being, you know, beaten into smithereens.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that would be one.
Mm-hmm.
But are there others?
Your Honor, it only takes one attack, of course, to establish a claim. I think if we look to the incidents that took place, for example, within a few weeks in March of 2001, Mr. Grievason suffers his sixth assault. This is the assault in which, as you point out, Defendant Hybaugh personally witnessed yet refused to intervene. It's also reflected in the jail medical records that Mr. Grievason, or that the jail medical officer spoke with Defendant Hybaugh in that case. On March 14th, Mr. Grievason puts in a grievance form, or attempts to put in a grievance form, reporting his multiple assaults and asking to be moved. This grievance form is not accounted for in the defendant's records, but the jail is on. Mr. Grievason specifically attests that he notified the jail of his problems and asked to be moved. On March 21st, he suffers his seventh and most damaging, most serious beating incident.
Now, do we know if he put that sixth request into the box that the inmates are picking up or beneath the tray, mm-hmm. the old food trays that the inmates are picking, where anyone can find anything and do anything? Mm-hmm. That they want with it?
Mr. Grievason did not trust the food tray system, which was one of the express ways that the jail says inmates were supposed to bring these problems to jail officials' attention. He says he typically either, if the guard would not accept the grievance from him personally, he would put it into the inmate mailbox, which was insecure, which was a cardboard box taped to the bars, which any inmate, according to Mr. Grievason in his affidavits, could rummage through at will. Getting back to Judge...
What about these instances, however, where he says that he slipped getting out of the shower or that he fell? Or
mm-hmm.
How does that comport with saying I'm being attacked?
Judge Kaney, in both of those times where defendants' records show that, you know, essentially they portray him as a klutz. He slipped in puddled water. He slipped getting out of the shower. Both times in the record, in his affidavits, he specifically says, and as soon as I got out of earshot of the other inmates, I told the guard what had really happened, that I had been beaten. Mr. Grievason's injuries, especially from the seventh beating, a shattered eye socket which damaged his optic nerve and which continues to cause him debilitating pain now that he's a free man trying to live a quiet life in Canada. It's almost inconceivable how an injury that serious could have been caused by slipping in puddled water. But more importantly, he says in each occasion he told the real story specifically to jail officials that was his, if he said that at all, it was his cover story while the other inmates were around. Judge Easterbrook, if I may, I'd like to get back to your question briefly about the individual defendants, because he does name the individual guards in places in his affidavits. We believe that a reasonable jury could infer that these are the guards he dealt with on a daily basis. These are the guards who would have been on notice. There is good authority for the prospect that if a person is under threat, is regarded as a snitch, is in difficulty, the fact he directs his pleas to the world at large rather than to one specific named defendant should not necessarily be enough to grant summary judgment for that named defendant. And so we think there is enough evidence in the pro se materials he put together for a jury.
Most of the time he wasn't pro se. This suit began with plaintiff having retained counsel.
That's correct.
A large part of the problem is that his lawyer bungled the job. Now, one might think there's a large opportunity for a malpractice suit against his first lawyer, the one who filed the absurd Anders brief.
That's correct.
But it's awfully hard to say that, you know, we should excuse the plaintiff because he was pro se when for the bulk of the time in the district court he had a lawyer. Just that his lawyer wasn't very good.
Judge Easterbrook, he may have had a lawyer for the bulk of the time. The lawyer withdrew more than a year before the grant of summary judgment. At my fingertips, I don't have the dates of Mr. Grievous's affidavits, but I believe it's clear in the record that he prepared his affidavits. He certainly prepared his own summary judgment brief entirely pro se. So he was pro se during any of the critical events in building the record and in defending his case.
I think his lawyer was so bad that he was effectively pro se from the start.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
That's the basis of malpractice law.
He appears to have withdrawn because he realized the case would actually require some work to prosecute, and Mr. Grievson wasn't willing to go along with a settlement.
And it would certainly seem as if the district court adopted a version of the facts that favors the defendants, who were the moving parties. And, of course, that's in contravention of summary judgment law.
That is specifically our argument in the first part of our brief, Your Honor, that the district court, what's needed in this case is not a limited remand to the district court to clarify its analysis, because in this case, respectfully to the district court, there was no analysis. Not a single shred of Mr. Grievous's summary judgment evidence was not only not analyzed, but was not acknowledged by the district court. The district court clearly appears to have adopted the facts and drawn all inferences in favor of the moving party as opposed to the non-movement in this case. And that alone should be enough to defeat summary judgment, to reverse summary judgment. I see I've entered my rebuttal. Yes.
Ask one more question about whether the record ties the defendants to particular wrongs. The allegations about the handling of the medicine certainly accuse the nurses of egregious behavior. Mm-hmm. Does the record tie particular defendants to that behavior?
The record does not. The record ties the named defendants to inadequate response to his need for medical assistance the first time after the first beating. The record does not tie individual named defendants to the pattern on five separate occasions of being essentially handed an entire bottle of narcotics and said, being told, here's your medicine. That is why that is an official capacity claim. We believe there's clearly enough evidence.
You can't have an official capacity claim without an argument that it was the policy of the jail to do this. One shows the policy not by what happened to the plaintiff, but by what happens normally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, that should be easy. You get the records of the prison dispensary and find out what happens normally.
Mm-hmm. Does he have any information in the record about how the jail treated other injured prisoners? In other words, do we know whether entire bottles of pain pills were dispensed to other inmates or...
In his personal affidavits, he specifically says not only did this happen to him on at least five occasions, he observed it happening to other inmates as well. On the question of policy, certainly one way to establish a policy is to point to an express policy, but this court has held many times in cases such as Bowen and Wolf Lilly versus Sundquist that there may be local government liability, quote, even for informal actions if they reflect a general policy, custom, or pattern
of
conduct.
You get the prison dispensary records and see what they normally do. But otherwise, an argument like this happened to me repeatedly just completely bypasses Monell. Mm-hmm. Because then the plaintiff doesn't have to show a policy, he just has to show what happened to him.
Your Honor,
it has to be what happens generally.
Your Honor, I believe what he's showing is a widespread custom or practice which has the force of an official policy in this case, which is certainly an acceptable way to make a Monell claim.
I don't see how you can do that.
Okay. May I reserve the balance of my time?
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. Ms. Brandt. Well, Ms. Brandt, did your client look at the records?
Your Honor, in regard to the medical, the dispensing of the medication, that is not in the record, and I don't know the answer to that question.
But surely, when a suit makes allegations of this kind, the first thing counsel would do is make sure that the prison is not behaving in this way. Because if what the prisoner is alleging is true, the jurisdiction is grossly mistreating its prisoners, and you would want to stop that for humanitarian reasons, completely independent of any risk of liability. So my assumption is, unless you and your superiors and others working for Marion County are completely irresponsible, you would have immediately found out whether this is what's happening on a general basis.
And, Your Honor, we did do that, and that is in the record in response to the grievance system and in response to the training of the jail officials.
Well, your own medical records, forgive me, but your own medical records indicate that the jail knew that his pain pills were being stolen from him. And yet, I mean, that's in the medical records, and yet the jail continued to dispense, you know, pills a bottle at a time. And, the response when he begged for more was that he was a drug-seeking addict of some sort. But the fact that he asked to be given his pills one at a time, that surely would belie the nurse's claim that he was a drug-seeking addict. An addict doesn't say, just give me a pill every day. An addict says, give me give me a lot of pills. So, I mean, doesn't that take care of the problem here?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that in regard to whether this was a custom policy or practice, Mr. Grievous's personal experiences are not enough to show a widespread custom policy or practice that this is how things were done. In Palmer, the court has ruled that the inmate's individual observations through the year that he was in jail weren't enough to show that the jail was deliberately indifferent to inmate-on-inmate violence. Additionally, in Marchant, which we quoted in our brief, something similar was going on. The inmate was not given the doses per the prescription. Sometimes he wasn't given them at all. And in one case, he was actually given another inmate's prescription. And the court there ruled that it was not enough to show a constitutional violation.
But I noticed, unless I really missed something, that the defendants do not deny that inmates are dispensed entire bottles of painkillers all at once as a matter of course. And that, of course, is a breathtakingly risky practice in a prison setting. I mean, is there anything that I might have missed in the record that contradicts the plaintiff's claim about how medication was dispensed?
No, Your Honor.
Well, then doesn't he win that point?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that it's enough to show that there's a constitutional deprivation. Just because there might be a better policy out there doesn't automatically lead to a constitutional deprivation.
But even if the better policy is, well, we just throw them a bottle of, you know, some horrible pain pills, and if it's stolen from them, so they'll just have to wait till the next bottle comes up. I'd like to change the subject, if I could, for just a minute. And that's this, because there was something that I found particularly ironic, and that was an argument on page 18 of the state's brief, because that claims that Grievous had inadequate time to personally observe certain jail practices were so well settled that they had the force of official policy. And the reason he had inadequate time to observe the jail policies, according to the state, was that he was constantly moved in and out of his cell block for hospital visits, which sometimes lasted days. So why can't we take the admission by the state that a plaintiff is being constantly in and out of the hospital as evidence that the jail is on notice that a plaintiff is being attacked with such great frequency, and the attacks are resulting in such severe injuries that he's being taken back and forth to a hospital all the time.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the standard is that Mr. Grievous either has to alert the jail officials to an identifiable threat to his safety or show the existence of so substantial a risk of harm that their knowledge can be inferred. If you look at the record...
How can it not be inferred? You're the ones moving. He's not saying, well, I think today is Tuesday and I think I'm going to go to the hospital. It's you who's taking him back and forth to the hospital. You know that you're taking him back, and he can't go to the hospital without you taking him to the hospital.
Correct, Your Honor, but when we look at the record and look at the reasons that he's giving for his injuries, they are all over the board. As was mentioned before, he indicated to jail officials that for the very first attack that he was attacked by a specific inmate, but the problem was taken out of the block. One of the next attacks was he said he slipped and fell in a puddle of water. His next attack, he said that he fell getting out of the shower. Another one was because...
Of course, he changed those immediately. I mean, as soon as he got to, where he felt safe, he did change those stories, and he was, afraid. And, I mean, the idea is you took him out of a cell with one person in it, you know, the person that may or may not be the very reason for all this, and you take him and you put him in with 45 other offenders when you could have put him in a single cell. I mean, my God, what this guy went through.
Yes, Your Honor, but my point is that the jail doesn't have a duty to guarantee his safety. The jail needed to have some notion that there was an attack going to... He feared for his safety of something. In Lewis, the court ruled that there was no constitutional deprivation after a second attack, even though the jail had been notified of the circumstances and the individuals in the first attack because they weren't notified.
You know, we're talking about seven attacks. We're not talking about two attacks. We have a case here where the district judge himself, overseeing Grievous's criminal case, intervenes and removes him from the jail pending the sentence. Now, my question would be, can the district court use that intervention as evidence about the severity of the situation and to show knowledge on the part of jail officials that Grievouson in particular was at an elevated risk? It's very unusual for, you know, another judge to say, hey, wait a minute, enough is enough. And
no,
that's what it took here.
No, Your Honor, I would argue that under Federal Rule 403, the Judge Barker, who I believe oversaw Grievouson's criminal trial, those orders would not be admissible in this civil suit, because they don't deal with the same issues. They deal with his criminal case.
No. She took him out so she didn't have to sentence a dead man, basically. That's why she took him out.
And Your Honor, I would go back and press to the court that Mr. Grievouson filed five grievances through the grievance system, and none of those did he mention fear for his safety, specific threats. He only focused on the fact that he didn't feel like he was getting medical care in a timely fashion. The jail officials don't have the obligation to be mind readers, and when it comes out later that Mr. Grievouson alleges that you know, beaten
up. You have the actual grievances where he said it, whatever he said, didn't mention an attack or didn't mention threats?
Yes, Your Honor, and those are in the record.
Against what are his affidavits or statements?
Against his later affidavits or statements,
right,
which say, well, yes, I might have said this, but later I really told them the real story. And the district court was proper in really disregarding those. If there are later affidavits which contradict previous sworn testimony, and usually it's in the form of a deposition, the district court is proper to disregard those affidavits now that he has the potential, now that he's involved in this civil suit for these alleged violations. It was clear that Mr. Grievason knew how to use the grievance system. He did it 5 times. He got reports back about the delays in medical care and the disposition of those grievances, and he chose to use it sometimes, and he chose to not use it other times. And I think that the district court was perfectly within its right to look at those conflicting statements and disregard the latter ones now that he has this civil interest. Further, when looking at Mr. Grievason's affidavits, while they were written pro se, I think it's important to look at what the district court was looking at. Mr. Grievason's affidavits are filled with statements and allegations more proper for a complaint than for an affidavit based on personal knowledge. He constantly testifies as to what jail officials knew, what they should have known, what was completely obvious. He some of his statements are just questions. He even states in one statement of his affidavit that the ones I had no contact with should have known what was going on, which brings us back to the very first issue with the personal liability of individuals Jack Cotty and Patrick Comiskey especially. There's no evidence whatsoever in Mr. Grievason's brief or affidavits that he even interacted with those two individuals. And to maintain that Section 1983 claim, you've got to show that the individual took part in that constitutional deprivation. And especially with those two gentlemen, there is no evidence. And the district court was very correct in that aspect.
You see, for me, the case stands out for many of the failure to protect cases that, you know, we see these a lot, of course, because of the large number of assaults and the well-documented medical records evidencing the injuries, all of these hospital stays. He has some evidence the prison officials knew he'd been labeled a snitch. But beyond that, what we've got here is a sheer number and severity of the assaults that, you know, does nothing put the defendants on notice that a plaintiff is being targeted and needed special protection. And, I mean, what kind of procedures are there where you've got an open box that any of the, prisoners can see, what's been written out, or placing a grievance on a meal tray where inmates had access to the meal trays? I mean, if you were being beaten up time and time again, who in their right mind would then, you know, add to that by placing grievances where the perpetrators can see them?
Well, Your Honor, I'd go back to the first assault, and even in Mr. Grievason's record, he's asked by a jail official about the problem, and he says, no, it's been taken out of the block already. He's got to let the jail officials know what was going on. If he doesn't, it's a pretty high standard to show that there's so substantial a risk that it can be inferred. And these random attacks for, you know, losing a card game, taking too long on the toilet, there's no way for the jail officials to really anticipate that he's being specifically targeted for being a snitch or for whatever reason.
Even though in his first complaint he said this is for being a snitch on Art
Schliester, I believe, Schliester, Judge, but I'm not sure.
This is retaliation for Schliester.
But he never... But, Your Honor, in his affidavits, he alleges that, but he also doesn't... I mean, that's just another allegation. It's just another allegation similar to what jail officials should have known or what they knew, and I see my
but
time...
But they took him out of that cell.
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
So why did they take him out of the cell if they weren't aware that something terrible is going on?
Well, Your Honor, from the record, he was taken out of the cell at the request of an individual who was working with the Marion County Grand Jury in this Art Schliester investigation, who was good friends with Mr. Grievason. So they decided to place him in a different cell just in case he would tip off Mr. Schliester as to what was going on, and at the request of his friend, who was concerned about that.
Ms. Brandt, let me ask you one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're from the Office of Corporation Counsel for the City of Indianapolis?
Yes, Your Honor.
How does that relate to Marion County and the sheriff?
Well, Your Honor, in Indianapolis, we have a consolidated city-county, and so the Office of Corporation Counsel represents now it's consolidated, Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department, which is also the Marion County Sheriff's Department and the Indianapolis Police Department, as well as all county organizations. So we also represent the Sheriff's Department as well for Marion County.
Okay. There's no name change to any of this?
No, Your Honor, because the jail is still run by the Marion County Sheriff's Department.
Is there still a sheriff?
Yes, Your Honor.
But it's combined with the Indianapolis Police Department?
Well, the law enforcement aspect is combined with the Indianapolis Police Department. The jail facility is still Sheriff's Department.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Brandt. Anything further, Mr. Sanders?
Your Honor, contrary to the impression that counsel may have left, Mr. Gibson never changed his story. What we have is one version from defendant's records and another version from Mr. Grievason's affidavits. He was never deposed. He never changed his story. He was never subject to questioning on this. On the Monell claims, a jail has no requirement to guarantee safety. It is under an obligation to avoid and prevent Eighth Amendment violations. The argument here is that the operation in practice of the grievance policy and the practices, well documented multiple occasions, of the way medicines were dispensed were informal practices or customs which achieved the permanence and the solidity of a policy, and it was those policies that prevented the jail from being aware of substantial risks to inmate safety and preventing substantial risks to inmate safety and health. It was the operation of those informal de facto customs and policies which were tolerated by the jail officials. If there are no further questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you
very much. Well, the case is taken under advisement. Mr. Sanders, we want to thank you and your law firm for your willingness to accept the appointment in this case.
Thank you.
And you've been of assistance to the court as well as to your client. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.